now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we're talking about impressive wins for Nottingham Forest and Sheffield United and a battling point for Luton Town. We'll also discuss Arsenal, Emma Hayes, and we've got some listener feedback on Manchester United. Joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we've got two of the brightest football writers in the country in Alison Rudd and Tom Allnutt, and a former footballer who was once praised by Chris Wilder not only for being left-footed, but also for putting in consistent and steady performances. So let's hope he can do the same today. Gregor Robertson is with us too.
Hi, Tom.
Do you know where I found that from?
Go on.
A YouTube clip of Chris Wilder talking about you being signed after you'd been with them, I think on loan at Northampton, was it? Or for a brief spell, and then they re-signed you permanently?
I joined on a short-term deal when I left.
And then played so well that you got a new deal.
Oh, yeah, that's it.
But that
doesn't happen often.
That was really in the depths of the internet, that. So we've hit November and I'm already running low on facts about
your career. You this would happen. Listen, I warned you.
When Tom Clark is arrested for going on the dark web, we'll know why.
Yeah,
he just took his research too far.
Yeah, not trying to find anything dodgy, just trying to find facts about Gregor Robertson's career. Anyway, moving on, a team who haven't necessarily put in consistent and steady performances this season are Sheffield United. In fact, they are a team that we have mentioned on this podcast basically only in a negative manner. Well, boys, now's your time to shine, because you've got to win. And it was a wonderful win. We were looking at some of the pictures of the celebrations yesterday when we were editing the game pages. And I picked one of just the team looking completely overjoyed, slightly overwhelmed at Oliver Norwood's late winner. Gregor, you have covered Sheffield United quite a lot in pre-season. You've talked about them quite a lot in terms of their problems off the field. This is a huge win, isn't it, in terms of giving them some hope and a chance to get a victory at this point in the season, while there's still plenty of time still to play?
Yeah, I mean, obviously enormous getting their first win, particularly with the kind of reports that refused to go away about Chris Wilder waiting in the wings. I don't know, I think if I was Paul Heckenbottom, the fact that they just don't seem to go away would be getting quite annoying by now. I think it's annoyed the players. You saw Ollie Norwood coming out afterward, and he said they had a kind of players meeting to clear the air after the 5-0 defeat against Arsenal last week. Just to remind a few players, or in fact, tell a few players, because we have to remember this is quite a newly assembled team because of all the issues that Sheffield United endured during the summer, selling a lot of the best players, loan players leaving. So it was a kind of meeting to say, look, this is what Sheffield United have stood for a number of years now, i.e. in your face, pretty combative, aggressive, front foot, all those kind of words. All the words that you've heard Chris Wilder say many times, and Paul Heckingbottom kind of took forward as well afterwards. This is what Sheffield United are about. So we need to get back to that. And I think you saw that.
You saw that with the goals, didn't you? I think there was, I mean, Cameron Archer's was a fantastic finish, but when he was through on goal, I almost thought he took a touch that wasn't quite the right kind of striker's touch, so he ended up going, sod this, I'm just going to whack it.
Yeah, he was outside the box still, but it was kind of one-on-one. Yeah. You think you'd continue, but that's a great finish. And he's one player who actually you think there's a lot of potential for to be a Premier League player, whether Sheffield United are going to be in the Premier League next year or not. Same could be said of Hamer. So there've been players that have been trying to bed in, and there's also been some games, a lot of games they've been in and just not had anywhere near the kind of cutting instinct up front. I think it was the first shot on target in 200 minutes in the Premier League.
It was, yeah.
It's incredible stat that is. And also the kind of managing to concede late goals, and you know what happened against Spurs. Everton, another one you think of where they kind of Jordan Pickford pulled off that ridiculous double save in like the 98th minute or something. So there have been moments like that too, and a lot of them have been at home, and Bramall Lane will be big for them too. So I think you just saw the kind of the atmosphere that they're going to have to create and the spirit and fight that they're going to have to show to even have anywhere near like half a chance of staying up. Mm-hmm. And we saw it finally in this game.
Alison, you've been critical of them in the past, as we have all been critical of the promoted sides. At the start of this season, we kind of started sensing that maybe three up, three straight back down again. But this does at least show, as Gregor has outlined, some of that fighting spirit, which is important, not just for them and their fans, but I think for in the media and for neutral fans as well, so that they can latch onto them maybe and get behind them a little bit more.
Yeah, I haven't been that critical of them, actually. In fact, I think I tip them for Bramall Lane to be a significant factor in possibly offering an escape.
You did.
But, I mean, they're not a very good team. That's just... It's very easy when you see... I mean, the photograph that is in the game today, it honestly, if you just cut it out and showed it to, you know, 1,000 people, what does this picture say? So you say, oh, it's a cup final. Someone's just won a cup final, haven't they? That's what it looks like. And in its own way, that's quite embarrassing, isn't it? That they've had to wait so long to get a victory. They didn't play that well. Wolves played the attractive football. It was not a penalty, actually. No. So
a little.
They
soft,
got a bit of
look.
A little. It was very, very soft. Rarely do you see someone who's supposed to have committed a foul in tears, because it was just the sheer injustice of it. But. Having said that, if they know who they are and what their limitations are, which I think they do, and they know what they've got going for them, which is an ability to create team spirit, I think it's really fantastic that the players have had a chat and feel for their manager, actually. That's good. And they have they certainly give everything, and they're reasonably well organised. Whether it's enough to see them through, Who will know? But I mean, the whole weekend has shown that writing off... I mean, I think everyone thought this season's going to be really boring at the bottom of the table. It's going to be the three promoted sides and Bournemouth fighting for it. And what we've seen is that even though we're in November, it's still possible for one result to make you feel the axis is tilting slightly and all things are possible. I don't know where you go from this, though, if you're Sheffield United, because they won without playing particularly well. Do you double down on just trying to be as organised as you can and hope for... What are you hoping for? Are you hoping for a penalty that isn't a penalty? Are you hoping for a freak wonder strike? What are you hoping for? It's... I don't know. Are they going to grind it out with lots of nil nils and the odd wacky goal at home? It still seems unlikely that the fairy tale's possible.
Yeah, but isn't that slightly the point I was maybe trying to make and failed with the thing about just added confidence and having that winning feeling? And yes, you are quite right to point out that it did look like a bit like a cup upset. It was FA Cup weekend this weekend. I was looking at that picture and thinking, this looks like a small team that's just knocked out the big boys.
Yeah.
But do you not think, in terms of the progression of getting to that point where they then maybe start playing better, that this needed to happen first? They needed to not play well, get a bit lucky.
Oh, you know, radical thought. You do need to win a game. Need to win one game, yeah.
But for you to get to that point, they can't just suddenly start playing brilliant football when they've been struggling and beaten 8-0 and things. Do you not think they need to at least have that point, and that's why they can enjoy it more than maybe being worried about...
No problem with them enjoying it whatsoever, but what is that? Yes, the emotional side of it, fantastic. But if you analyse the match, what actually will they be building on? They are. You can't build on a bad refereeing decision.
Spirit, fight, and well organised, well drilled.
They conceded late as well, so they were winning the game for a period of time. I think also, you look, they were due a bit of a rub of the green.
Mm.
Number of injuries they've had, like big important players, John Egan, their captain, a lot of players at the back, out for months. And if you look through the games, looking back again, Forest scored a late winner. Man City, they played exactly that kind of football. It was like, I think they had like 20% of the ball sat in, scored And then Man City scored a really late winner again. We know what happened at Tottenham. That was like the latest I think there's ever been a victory in the Premier League because of all the added time now. Everton, again, they could have won it late. Man United, Dalot scored in like the 77th minute, like a wonder goal. So they've been unlucky. So I think they can feel entitled to say we deserved a bit of luck in this. And from all those things, those attributes that I've referenced, the spirit, the fight, and all that stuff, they earned it.
Tom, where do you sit on the debate? Not good win, lads. Glad you got off the mark, but not that impressive. Or bit of fighting spirit to be impressed by.
I think Alison's definitely being critical. She claims she's never been, then she tells poor old Sheffield United it's embarrassing to be celebrating their one win of the season. I mean, I think it's entirely fair enough. You know, I mean, these teams are coming out. We were talking the last few weeks about how the Premier League looks like it's of a 16 team division and a bottom four, and it looked like they're all cut adrift. You know, and Sheffield United get their first win after 11 games. They're on minus 21 goal difference. I mean, if you can't celebrate a victory in injury time, no matter how it comes about, and I take Alisson's points, you know, that, you know, they had, what, 35% possession or something. You know, they weren't particularly deserving of the win. I think the decision was soft, I think, is a good way to describe it. I wouldn't say it was a howler. I can see them given, don't you think? I mean, he put his foot in there. He was a little bit... didn't get much of the ball. It wasn't a penalty, but I don't think it's something you would look back on in a few weeks and say that was, you know, a terrible decision.
Certainly see Mo Salah win the odd one every now and again.
Hey, it's a dive, let's be honest. It was a dive.
He made more of it than it was, no doubt about that. But, you know, these things, sometimes teams can look dead and buried in the first few weeks, and it takes a while for them to adjust to the Premier League, you know, to find their feet. And what Gregor said up working bottom as well, you know, I think in a way sometimes results and victories, they do shift momentum, they do shift belief. And it's all very well to kind of say what can we see here with a Sheffield United team they actually can kind of cling on to for the next few weeks, but sometimes results dictate that. You know, when you look at Manchester United, you have a really good team and the results are dictating the way very good players are playing, and it can work the other way around. You know, you can have a result like this, slightly fortunate, yes, but the lift that it gives the club, the belief it instills in the manager suddenly, that can suddenly make 5-6 out of 10 players play like 7 or 8 out of 10 players, and that can make a big difference.
This isn't a Premier League team. Like Alisson's right, they aren't. You look at this team on paper and you look at the... They aren't Premier League players, a lot of them. But they kind of never were, even when Chris Wilder had them up, you know, with a kind of... I think, what did they finish? 9th? Something like that? Mm. They had a real structure and they had a kind of mentality that got them results. And Heckenbottom did something very similar to get them promoted. And it was ripped up in the summer. And he's been battling to try and get them kind of organised and, you know... a group of players that know what he wants from them again. Because even I remember when I went up there before the week before the season started, one of the things, you know, you think about, you lose in Dai and Berg, and a lot of it was goals. That was the two biggest chance creators, I think. And he actually turned around when I asked him about that. He said they were also two of our best pressers. Like we pressed really aggressively from the front. So it's not just the chance creation and the goals, it's the way we defend. Like, and that was true of the other players that went, Tommy Doyle, McAtee came back and he came on the second half and he was brilliant in this game. Be your eyes on deadline day. It was like, and Doyle was in the Wolves team. So that was, you know, he should have been in the Sheffield United team, they would have hoped. So I still think they've got a massive like uphill struggle to stay up, but seeing this, that kind of organisation spirit again, I think will give them huge sort of belief and just a real boost for the weeks to come.
A quick word on Wolves, because what this does is, you know, doesn't bring them closer or things like that. You know, they've been playing well, but it is a kind of reminder for Gary O'Neill that this is not as easy as maybe sometimes when he's on Monday Night Football talking about how to beat Pep Guardiola, shall we say. Because they missed a lot of chances again. It's still an issue for them. Is this a kind of reminder that this is their limitations? They're 14th at the minute with 12 points. Spring some surprises against some big teams. Maybe be upset, if we like, against the likes of Sheffield United, Alison.
It's a reminder that they're heavily reliant on Neto for that X factor of what makes them a difficult team to face. I think he's had a phenomenal season so far. And I don't know, does anyone know when he's back? Because, I mean, that's key. That's so key. He's just astonishing, and no team has actually found a way to keep him quiet. And I think possibly a combination of not having your best player there and knowing that you've struggled to score probably contributed to this defeat. But, well, I mean, there's a lot of shouting about VAR this season, but I think in total, Wolves have been the club that have suffered the most from very controversial, unfair decisions for them. You know, you could be talking 9, maybe more points that have gone for them after some good performances. This wasn't a bad performance. This was a combination of missing your best player, VAR going against you, and having that problem that most clubs that aren't very, very, very wealthy have, which is you need to spend money on people who can finish, and most clubs don't have that. I think they'll be absolutely fine, though. And I don't know, it used to be manager of the month was a curse. Is being invited onto Monday Night Football now the new thing that makes things bad? Thomas Frank proved that it isn't.
Oh, well, there you go. But it's an interesting theory.
The similarities with that penalty to the one that Hwang did a couple of weeks ago were remarkable, though. Kind of both aware that we're just about to make a foul in the penalty box, stopping, and still the player going over and buying the foul. It's like, yeah, I agree with Alison. I think them and Brighton have had a few as well, but Wolves have had some real stinkers in the recent weeks. I mean, Arteta needs to have a look at himself.
Well, we'll come on to Mikel Arteta's comments about VAR a little bit later on. But moving on, another team we haven't given too much praise to are Nottingham Forest. As I said, I was editing our football coverage this weekend, and I thought they were one of the standout performers. It was a brilliant performance in their win against Aston Villa. We'll talk a little bit about Villa and Unai Emery later on. Gregor, I asked you the other week briefly about how you felt Forest, your old team, had been performing this season. This was a kind of classic Steve Cooper performance, wasn't it? Impressive pressing. That's much harder to say than I thought in my head. From the front, and a lot of players really stepping up. I thought Ola Aina's finish was absolutely brilliant, wasn't it? Yeah. And Harry Toffolo, someone that I know from playing for Lincoln, who when they signed for the Premier League, I thought, I'm not sure he's quite good enough for the Premier League, but actually he was brilliant, man of the match, 2 assists. It feels like a little bit of the kind of madness is a little bit calmed down and they're focusing on the football.
Yeah, although, I mean, if you kind of took the temperature at the City Ground before this one, there were kind of reports were saying Marinakis is here. He's come over from Greece. They've not won in 6 games. He wants to understand why a positive start to the season has kind of started to look a bit shaky. You know, none of this is helpful, and it's always there. It's always kind of, it's always either very close to, you know, to being this sort of cloud, this sort of overarching sort of weight of pressure. Because, you know, Marinakis is hugely ambitious, but it's not helpful. It's not helpful to Cooper. It's not helpful to the squad. So, you know, the fans don't feel any of this. They're absolutely behind Steve Cooper. But there was pressure. I read one report that was saying, you know, Steve Cooper's name was trending on Twitter after the game, and not for that reason. You know, it's like there were fears that, you know, he could be sacked at any moment. So, but having said that, they hadn't won at the City Ground for a while. They'd had draws against Luton the last time where they were 2-0 up, and they have kind of, although they've been positive performances, they've just not got the points to show for it. And as you say, they really tried to press high, but they also tried to exploit Villa's high line. And I remember watching Villa against Chelsea, and it's extraordinary to watch the kind of anxiety you must feel when you're a Villa defender sometimes, because you're running back just hoping and praying that the flag's going to come, and often it does. Because they're actually good at it. You know, Forrest had a few chances where but still the kind of the feeling that you have is, oh, Villa, you know, they're treading a fine line here, but they're very good at it. So Forrest still tried to exploit that, playing balls in behind for Awoniyi and Alanga and Gibbs White. And as you say, the finish by Aina was exquisite. And highlighting him is sort of underlines the job that Steve Cooper has had to do, right? So since they've been promoted, they signed Neco Williams, right back, Sergio Aurier, right back, Montiel, 4 right backs among their 40 odd signings, 13 this summer, 40 overall. And so when there's chopping and changing, and you wonder how he chooses his best team, like, it's just been a constant process for him ever since they've been promoted. And you look at Aina and you think, why have we not seen more of him? Why is he, you know, he looked brilliant. because they've signed so many players, and maybe some are picking up injuries and not getting a good run in the team. Same with Toffolo, he's had his injury troubles. If they can get a settled side, and they've got we know that Cooper, Forrest under Cooper have a really solid structure, then I think it could be a positive season for them, like kind of pushing to be in the top half of the table.
Yeah. The most impressive thing I think about the Forest performance was how, given everything you've just outlined there, Gregor, is how they looked like a proper unit, and they looked like a team, and they looked like they were fighting for each other, and they understood each other's runs. They looked like they've been playing that starting 11 a lot when they haven't, and that's an incredible achievement from a manager, I think, to have so many changes and yet to look like everyone slots in.
It's interesting because I thought exactly that watching the game, to the point where I spoke to Opta this morning to ask for the stats, thinking, oh, well, they've had much more settled side this season. That must be what it is. Total players used this season, 27 Nottingham Forest, the most of any team.
Exactly.
Total starting 11 changes, 26 Nottingham Forest, third behind Manchester City and Brighton. Compared that to last season, they're actually higher in both tables than they were last season. And I thought, I was excited. As I say, Alison, I watched that game thinking, these guys must really know each other. Because I've not been paying as much attention to Forest in recent weeks. But actually, it's still all the same things they were dealing with last season, which is, as you say, incredibly impressive. Tom, where do you think Forest lie here in terms of, particularly maybe in relation to our conversation around Sheffield United and Burnley and Luton and the teams that came up? Because last season, they slightly filled that role of, oh God, they're never going to pull this off. Slightly for different reasons, because they were spending so much money. Where do you think they sit now in the kind of table of how fans think of them?
I really like Murillo as well, the centre-back from Corinthians. He's made a big difference. Yeah. There's been a bit of uncertainty in defence of who the kind of best pairing is, and he's just come in there and I think made a big difference. He's 21 years old. I think Napoli were really interested in the summer. It really kind of speaks to the kind of dominance of the Premier League, obviously, that a club like Forest can sort of lure these Brazilian defenders from South America, you know, and they're very young, very highly rated in Europe, and they just want to basically play in the Premier League. And even if that's a stepping stone to one of the bigger teams, so be it. I mean, I think Forest will be fine. You know, I think, you know, the only way that they could mess it up is if they sack Steve Cooper, I guess. You know, if they decide that they need to make a change and bring in someone else, and then suddenly you've got a huge squad of players and you've got a new coach who has no idea, you know, who the best ones are, and you have to rip the whole thing up and start again. With Cooper, I think they'll be fine. They'll be in that kind of group of teams between about sort of 9th and 15th. We're talking about Wolves as well, in that kind of area. You know, I think they're strong enough at home, and I think with Cooper they've got enough organisation and enough about them that they're not going to get pulled into that bottom four. I mean, you know, there's no way that I see them in the same kind of category as Sheffield United, for example.
Interesting. Gregor, agree?
Yeah, no, I absolutely. I'm just always scared for Steve Cooper. I always have been.
You're always very worried about.
But because you look around them, like, I have so many reports about, so all the injury troubles, the hierarchy, like sack people and bring in a new head of performance, all the signings, like this plethora of signings, and they go, this hasn't been done very well. They sack the kind of director of football, bring in a new like sporting director. Ross Wilson's the latest one, I think. So like this is all going on around them as well. Like it's like they've kind of resisted this urge, or they've just not been able to find someone at the right time to replace Steve Cooper. I'm convinced that they've wanted to do it on a number of occasions, and it's just not a good environment for them. So he needs to, you know, if he gets enough results and kind of they are around the middle, you know, or top half of the table, then that kind of eases all that conversation. Otherwise, it's always going to be there.
On to Aston Villa. I was speaking to Charlotte Dunker, who was at the game, and when she rang in from the press conference, I was quite surprised by Unai Emery's comments. It sounded a little bit stroppy and less composed than normal. Today was a key moment, he said. We could really be a contender in the top seven teams. We have lost that opportunity. We had chances, and usually at home we are scoring them, but we didn't today. Is that just a case of they've been on a good run and this is a bit of a bubble burst, or is he actually speaking truth there, that actually they might struggle for top seven? Because to me, this didn't feel like, it felt like a dip, maybe off the back of, you know, Europa League hangovers and things, but it didn't feel like a real disjointed performance.
I suspect he was discombobulated and a bit cross because he didn't see it coming. Because Villa didn't really look like Villa, and they didn't get out of third gear, I don't think.
They didn't look like scoring to me.
They looked quite flat and unable to lift, to respond to what they were facing. And if you've gone through the prep, and we all know Emery is really into the fine detail, and you've gone through it all and pointed out, you know, where the threats will come from, what you have to put cope with, and so on. And they just don't. As a coach, there's very little you can do except hope that your words afterwards are, you know, enough to shake people up and make them think, oh, hang on a minute, maybe we were starting to, you know, read the good reviews and believe we were rather special. Because there's been a lot of nice stuff about Villa, not just on the game. I mean, everywhere. People have been gushing about him, the job he's done, how he's found the right place. Aren't they lucky to have him? Villa fans, they just stack the phone-ins with how much they adore what he's doing for them. And sometimes, subconsciously, that, and you're in a game, you're expected to win, that can subconsciously mean you just don't find that ability to raise your level. Because Villa are, let's remember, they are generally playing above themselves. And if you just allow yourself to be who you are and not give it that extra whatever percent it is, they can look quite ordinary. That's why he's cross.
Tom, would you agree with that statement based on Unai Emery, you know, someone that you followed in Spanish football before? Is this a little bit tactical or is it a bit stroppy?
I think I sort of agree with Alison. I think he's probably trying to burst the bubble a little bit. You know, he probably thinks that maybe the players have started to believe their own hype a little. Emery doesn't tend to be someone who kind of explodes in press conferences after matches. He usually kind of goes on long kind of, I wouldn't say rants, but sort of lectures about tactical systems and things, and everyone kind of switches off. And it's quite a clever way of sort of distracting. So I wonder if he was frustrated. You know, I think after matches, managers always say things sometimes they don't mean, and you know, that can obviously happen. But I do think that he probably looked at the performance and saw that it lacked a bit of energy, a bit of zip. And maybe he started to think that his players are starting to believe their own hype a little. But, I mean, equally, you know, this is what defines teams that kind of finish between third and eighth. You know, this is why they are what they are. They do lose the odd game away from home against teams when they play well. You know, they're obviously not super consistent all the time, and I think that's where Villa are going to be. You know, they're going to win three or four and then lose the odd one as well. And this doesn't mean they're not a good team. I don't think it means they're not going to be in the race for the top four at the end of the season. I think they're right there. You know, they've got a good squad, but it does depend on people like Watkins taking his chances. You know, and he didn't in this game. He had two or three really good chances and missed them. And I think those fine margins are there. They haven't got the players necessary to bring on to make a big difference. They're relying on those two or three key players making the difference in those matches. And it can happen. But I think this doesn't change my mind about what Villa are. I think they've got a great chance of finishing in those European spots.
Also, Martinez threw in the second.
He did.
And
yeah.
It gave Forrest something to hold on to. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't their best day, but I thought, you know, they've been on an incredible run. And Tom's right. That's why they're in that group of clubs chasing to kind of get into the elite pack. They're not quite there yet.
Now, one team we have discussed in a great deal in recent weeks, Manchester United. So I don't want to mention their win against Fulham in too much detail because we've talked about them a lot. But Alison, you were there. I wanted to ask first how Erik ten Hag seemed in the press conferences after the game. Did he seem like a man relieved? Did he seem like a man still on the brink?
It's hard to tell with him. He's so impassive. I find him deeply unimpressive in press conferences and on the touchline, actually.
Do you say that as a journalist or as someone looking for character from a man needed for a big job? I'm genuinely, you know, because there are lots of people I find unimpressive because they don't give good quotes. As an editor, I'm like, that's a rubbish quote. I can't get anything out of that.
Okay. Yeah.
But are you talking as a football fan looking for something, you know,
both,
a bigger meaning?
Both. Journalistically, he doesn't say very much of interest at all. And in terms of just liking football and wanting to see how teams are put together and who's in charge of them, he's unimpressive. And I struggle to see how he can be that different in the dressing room when he's trying to get them going or whatever it is he does. I mean, I think he's probably quite an intellectual manager and his forte is not doing rousing speeches, but he was playing politics afterwards because, you know, the questioning was, you must be very pleased with the win, but perhaps you understood that the performance wasn't quite there. You know, people were trying to tease it out of him, and he wasn't really answering at all. He called it a solid performance. I mean, he was deliberately batting it away and refusing to engage in the bigger dialogue, which is what is wrong with Manchester United, and didn't you get very lucky to win a game where you were not the best team on the pitch? So I find his touchline demeanour peculiar, really strange. And then there was...
What do you want from him more? Because he's quite passive, isn't he?
He's incredibly passive.
Contemplative.
That's not journalist, just journalist, by the way. I mean, he interviewed... I think it was he interviewed for Tottenham, a Tottenham job. I can't remember which one now. I've been so many in the last 2 or 3 years. And they basically decided that he didn't have the charisma and the pizzazz to kind of survive in the Premier League. You know, they thought, oh, he's a good coach, but he just didn't come across well, you know. And you can see that, right?
Well, so at Craven Cottage, the away fans, they were great. They made their protest with a sheet saying "Play like you mean it," but for most of it, they were very supportive. And when they scored their very late winner, there was a communal thing going on. All the United players went to the away fans, and it was proper mad hysteria. "We love you, and we love you back." Crazy stuff. And you think, ah, well, okay, there's something still there. For all the problems there are at Manchester United and all the disquiet amongst the fan base for what's going on with the ownership, there is still this incredible connection between the fans and the team, and the sense that they have, the players, most of them do feel the connection and that they're playing for a big club. And they were absolutely delighted and so on. Not shamefaced at all, that they just grabbed a winner they did not deserve.
You're not going to be shamefaced when you score a...
No, but you know, sometimes teams don't quite go as berserk as that when they're a big club like Man United. And you just feel they haven't got on the touchline a manager who is buying into any of that at all. That for... He could have... The team lack... They lack pizzazz on the pitch, and that has to be a reflection of him, I feel. Like, you sort of get the impression that not everyone playing believes in the system. Like, it's a very good question to ask, is why did he start with Antony? Because Antony gave nothing except fuel to people who think that Ten Hag has favourites, fuel to the fans to feel embarrassed, fuel to the away fans to boo him because of what's going on in his private life. And he did nothing. He was overwhelmed by being booed. He was slow. He didn't look like he was particularly interested. He made Anthony Robinson, the Fulham fullback, look twice as fast as he normally looks. He is quite fast, but he looked extra fast and extra clever and was able to play some neat stuff because he wasn't bothered by Anthony whatsoever. And you think, oh, okay, well, there's a disconnect here between getting a team out on the pitch that everyone believes in and making them feel passionate about playing for Manchester United. It's as if he's almost technically above it and can't quite believe he's reduced to having to play on the break.
Well,
do United have that you know, are impressive in these areas? I know we keep talking about...
Wide areas or generally?
Well, come on, we could talk about generally, but we'll just talk about like that front four. Like, we keep saying, why did he play him? And then when he plays someone else, he's like, he's not offered much. And
the Antony one is back to Ten Hag because he signed him, and he's the second most expensive player ever.
Many times. And you know, that's going to be the biggest stick to beat him with, absolutely. So, but there's also, you know, he wants them to be the player that he signed. He wants them to do it. We want to see a burst of life and hope it comes at some point and maybe fool him away. It didn't. So, like, again, it's another reason to slag him off. But, and also just on his like demeanour, you know, it wasn't that long ago that everyone was saying, you know, who's this, you know, they've got a professional now after the guy who should never have had the job in Ollie, they've got someone who's a proper coach who, after they won the cup, people were saying he was going to build a dynasty. So like a few months down the line, I think to suddenly flip it around and say that he looks like he doesn't know what he's doing on the touchline, or he's...
Well, I've never
he's
not thought got, he looks like he
he's not got any. He's not got any. He's not got the right kind of pizzazz. I think there are far bigger problems at Manchester United than Erik ten Hag.
Well, we are in a dangerous territory of falling back into Thursday's debate, heated debate around Manchester United, which was a very interesting discussion, and it prompted Martin Ralph, a Manchester United fan, to get in touch to say, "Tom, you asked on the recent podcast for United fans to speak up. And he then sent a very long and interesting explainer of his thoughts. I'm going to read a few bits of it just to give him the final word. How to fix it, to adapt the old Irish joke, if I wanted to fix United, I wouldn't start from here. Everything is wrong. I fear it is unfixable as it stands and it will take many years to recover from. He said this about Erik ten Hag, which I think leans more towards your point, Gregor. If the Glazers don't go, nothing will change for the good. Swapping Ten Hag, who admittedly now seems to be in some sort of death spiral, will do no real good. An immediate uplift from that, and then the cycle kicks back in. The rumours that Ten Hag is too much of a disciplinarian and too hard in training, these things emanated from the dressing room before his appointment when it was revealed that the squad wanted Pochettino, who would have been a softer touch. The squad really don't like running, as we see in every game. So there you go, Gregor. I think you've got some support in the kind of
stuff.
From the listeners there. Martin, thank you very much for getting in touch. And if you are a fan of any team, doesn't have to be Manchester United, you can get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. If you want to share an opinion or have a moan that we've not mentioned your team or suggest a topic for the future. But we've got more topics to come on this show. Stick with us. Up next, we're talking Luton, Liverpool and Arsenal, Newcastle.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark and I'm joined by Alison Rudd, Gregor Robson and Tom Allnut to Kenilworth Road. And Luton, another promoted side who we can be impressed by, Alison Rudd is rolling her eyes just because we know she knows we're about to slag off Liverpool for being absolutely rubbish and getting away with a lucky point against the mighty Luton. But we are going to talk about Luton. Gregor, they, like Sheffield United, showed a lot of the characteristics that we had talked about before the start of the season and the things that you had wanted to see and that you had quite rightly said, look, these guys are going to have a chance because they have got a lot of these characteristics. And I thought they were brilliant. I think the game plan, which seemed to be let's get to half time and then have a go, worked brilliantly, didn't it?
Yeah, we also saw, you know, all the kind of that whole narrative about Kenilworth Road. I think it's probably the first time we really saw it, a bit of a, you know, an evening kickoff against a big team like Liverpool. You know, I think it was the first time in 15 years that they'd been there, and the sort of the whole kind of the idea about their home form being so important, not just about the way they play, but also about the atmosphere and the location and everything about Kenilworth Road. So I think this is the first time we really saw that. But again, I kind of will sort of draw some parallels with Sheffield United. Like, again, this is not a team that really is a Premier League team, and they've got a massive uphill struggle, but there have been a lot of games that they've been in and been their game plan has been pretty similar. It's been about trying to be, you know, compact and disciplined and play on the break, and they've often been, you know, pretty good at it. I think they've got some really good ball carriers. Look, Benny, brilliant. Tyth Chong as well, who comes on, he's great at carrying the ball forward. And Morris is brilliant at holding up. So they have a kind of...
I thought Doughty at left wing-back as well looked kind of quite brave a lot of times. I think there was a moment where he almost nutted Darwin Núñez or someone right near his own goal and then brought it out through midfield in a very kind of like modern full-back, wing-back type way.
Yeah, I saw a stat about him the other day. It was like he's one of the most, you know, one of the most kind of creative footballers in the league, players in the league, in the Premier League. Like, his passing is leading towards more chances than most players in the league. He's been brilliant. And he signed another left back for like $6 million as well in the summer from Wolves. So, they have, and Kobori as well on the other side. I remember saw him in the opening day at Brighton, and he's kind of on loan from Man City, a real athlete. But again, as I say, they've done this in other games. They're just not always, and they could have lost this game. It's the same as Sheffield United and Wolves. The number of chances that Liverpool missed, Nunez in particular, it's like everyone's just started to talk about him being, you know, reaching these new heights, and then he's like, hold my beer, guys, and miss some absolute whoppers. It could have been different, but they stayed in the game, and as I say, they had players who, in those little the way that Barkley kind of, instead of just hooking it clear, manipulated a bit of space on the edge of the box and carried it forward, and then his pass was perfectly weighted. That was a bit of class. That was like, if they get him firing as well, he could be that kind of the link player, the kind of conduit between that block, that defensive block, and playing forward quickly. And also getting a bit, you know, Andros Townsend coming into the team, a bit of experience too, because they had none. So, yeah, hugely positive. It could have been better for them, obviously, if they'd won the game, but another big night for a team that everyone was really writing off, I think.
Alison, we will discuss Liverpool, but trying to discuss Luton without thinking about your team. Obviously, it's important to say as well, Greg is quite rightly highlighting the atmosphere at Kenilworth Road, but there was some incredibly disappointing chants heard from the Luton Town fans, which Henry Winter mentions in his match report, which is headlined, "Tragedy Chants Stir Poison into the Host's Passion." But in terms of the performance, Alison, were you impressed by Luton?
Yeah, no, I was, actually. I just did the yeah no thing that everyone does in football, didn't I? Because I'm feeling very stressed about talking about the game. Really. I was impressed, but so the way I watched it was I watched it with my children, and they were teasing me right from the start. You wouldn't mind, Mum, if Andros Townsend scored a great goal, would you? No, obviously I wouldn't mind. No, you wouldn't mind, Mum, if Luton got a bit of glory. No, it's fine. And I kept thinking, this good start by Luton will dissipate. No, they're growing in confidence. I was very impressed. I was impressed with how organised they were, how they didn't seem starstruck at all. They didn't wobble at the fact, you know, live game, big team, that's been playing incredibly well. They had bags of self-confidence. So I was impressed. I was prepared for Liverpool to concede. I felt, I do feel Liverpool will often. And that was fine. But I probably, if I had to pick out what impressed me the most, it was the character of the team, that they believed they could get something, and it wasn't a smash and grab sort of game, really. I know Liverpool had more chances and more possession, but the composure and there was some elegance on the ball as well, that it didn't feel like one of those upsets where, oh, you know, these things happen. It felt deserved that they would get a point from it. It was more than just the fact they had the home fans there, I felt. I felt Rob Edwards has been working. You have to decide, don't you, if it's not going that well for you when you're in a new division, do you just keep going a la Burnley, blindly just keep going, or do you feel there are signs of progress? And I think Luton have shown that by sticking to their principles and their plan and having faith in their more creative players, that they can get something from it, and they can take a lot more from this result, albeit only a draw, than I think Sheffield United can from theirs, because there's actual stuff to build on. You can see substantive elements of football and character and style and tactics and belief, and they looked like a mid-table team, not like a team that everyone thinks is going to go down. I was impressed.
Tom, in terms of Liverpool, we talked about Aston Villa and Unai Emery in terms of, you know, maybe taking the eye off the ball a little bit. Jurgen Klopp made changes to his team. Was this a little bit of a case of maybe giving your players the sense that this one's won already a little bit?
Maybe. I don't know if I got the sense of kind of complacency. I mean, I just think
I don't know, coming back to Darwin again, but just, you know, missing those chances. I mean, we really sort of felt like this might be kind of him turning a corner, but still in those kind of, you know, pressure moments, whether in the tight areas around the box, he just doesn't seem to have that kind of killer instinct. I always think he almost is, kind of rushes those chances. He doesn't have that ability that the real top strikers have, just to sort of take a moment and be able to kind of instill some calm into that kind of real panicked moment. He seems to rush things, you know. And I remember speaking to someone when he first arrived, and they sort of who knew him quite well and sort of looked at him before, and he just sort of said that things are done. He'll do everything very well in terms of the running and the intensity, and his physicality is excellent, but just surprised that a club like Liverpool would have signed him, because those sort of abilities aren't always that coachable, you know. That it was obvious that that was his big weakness, and even now, a year or what's it been, two years on, you know, we're still kind of talking about his lack of kind of composure and finishing. But perhaps it was just one of those games, you know, if we're being fair on him. Perhaps, let's see, you know, maybe he's, you know, on a kind of longer run where we see a different Darwin Núñez. But I thought that was really crucial. Obviously, the Luis Diaz thing at the end was very kind of pertinent, and, you know, and incredible really that he played and that he came on and that he scored the goal, and fair play to Klopp, I think, for managing that situation like that, understanding, you know, what the kind of the player wanted and was able to do. I mean, I think on Liverpool, I agree with Gregor. I mean, we talked a lot about Kenilworth Road, you know, and actually in reality it hasn't quite been what everyone was sort of writing about, you know, at the beginning of the season. Perhaps this was the first night where a team went there and found it very difficult. I think it's a possible starting point for Luton. For Liverpool, I think it's just a dip. I think I see them coming back pretty strongly.
In fairness to Darwin, like, Paul Joyce wrote a piece at the weekend highlighting that I think he had a goal contribution every 60 minutes so far. I think it was the second highest in Europe. So he's had a good season.
Oh yeah,
a bad day. It was like, but it was that kind of thing. It was just as everyone was starting to write those pieces and have that conversation. Is he he's stepping up to be the main man this season. Then he kind of did that. So it was unfortunate, but he still had a great season.
You're quite right. We have jinxed absolutely everyone on the Times Sports desk in recent weeks. We were discussing this before the show. We've done a piece on Darwin Núñez and he misses basically an open goal. We've done a piece about how there could be a five-team title race and basically everyone's dropped points apart from Manchester City, who win 6-1. And we've talked about how great Aston Villa are and then they lose at Nottingham Forest. So, yeah, I'm sorry for that, all the football fans.
What's
out
next?
There. Yeah, who knows what next? Maybe we need to say City have won the title already and start doing our pieces and see if that can get things a bit more exciting, because one of those teams who dropped points were Arsenal at Newcastle, losing the game 1-0. The game became far more about Mikel Arteta and his comments afterwards and the management of Arsenal and that kind of emotion that we've discussed so many times. We've got a couple of pieces on the Times website at the moment which people are reading in their numbers. One of them is Martin Samuel, whose intro is, "VAR is not the reason Arsenal sit fourth this morning, but their manager Mikel Arteta might just be." And another piece from Martin Hardy, which discusses Kai Havertz and that slightly brainless tackle, which I think probably should have been a red card, do we think? Quick show of hands.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a red card. Yes. Do you know what I
think? I think it's one of those ambers.
It's an orange from Gregor.
Yeah,
there you go.
Orange.
Oh, classic. At least Alisson's a former referee, so that adds some gravitas.
I think Bruno's could have been. There's not really much mitigation for that.
Well, we'll see. We
can get an off the ball. Yeah.
That was an off the ball incident. Yeah. Like, that was more surprising to me.
Yeah, well, we can get into that. But I think Martin Hardy's piece makes an interesting point in terms of he was discussing the piece with me and Joe, my colleague on the editing desk yesterday, and was saying that he felt Arsenal just lost sight of the idea that they could beat Newcastle at football and decided to have a fight with them instead. And how brainless that seemed to go to St James's Park on a kind of wet and wintry November night and decide to pick a fight with one of the teams that are best at having a fight in the Premier League. It just seemed completely off kilter from Mikel Arteta. But Martin's piece talks about Arteta's slight obsession with proving that Arsenal can have a fight and can win. And then they're not just the fancy team who play beautiful football. Tom, what do you think of that kind of assessment of Arteta and his management and where he's at now with Arsenal?
I think the best teams go to these kind of games and they impose control and they take the heat and the sting out of it. You know, if you see City and the way they approach these kind of matches, Guardiola's obsession is always with control of the ball and to try and dominate the match and not to kind of stoke the fire. I mean, the Havertz challenge was really reminiscent, I thought, of the Granit Xhaka challenge on Alexander-Arnold, you know, at Anfield, you know. And
which turned that game around,
Turned that game around and even, you know, the title race in a way. I just think Arsenal should have realised they're a better football team than Newcastle. They've got better football players, and if they'd played the game where they keep the ball and they create chances and they defend properly, then they could have got something out of the game. And actually, I think it does come down to Arteta. We've been talking about this for a long time now, where his emotional state on the sideline, I think, does create something in the team where they feel a certain sense of indignance and a certain sense of high emotional state all the time. And sometimes, you know, I think it's, of course, if you win games, last minute winners, and we were talking about Ten Hag earlier, so, you know, we can't have it always, then of course I think, you know, there is something in that, in the kind of big celebrations and the big statements. But I think to kind of always be so uptight, so sort of passionate, unhinged almost on the touchline, I think it does create a sense in the team, especially when you've got a young and very sort of malleable team like Arsenal's. We've got a lot of players who haven't necessarily been in these kind of situations before. I really think it does sort of filter down. And if we're talking about kind of the refereeing thing afterwards, you know, and his reaction, I mean, we're in November, you know, and they lost 1-0 to Newcastle. They're still in a good position in the league. And he's talking about it as though, you know, it was an absolute howler, and we'll get into that. Maybe I didn't personally think it was. I didn't think there was much in it. You know, I mean, it was ultimately what we're asking for from VAR. You know, we're asking for them not to intervene in decisions where it's slightly, you know, not absolutely clear cut. I didn't think it was a clear cut foul. You can maybe think it was or it wasn't, 60-40 either way. But it wasn't clear cut. And the other two, it couldn't decide. So if you can't ask VAR to guess. So, I mean, what do you want from the decision? It's almost like just because there were three, there was a cumulative, you know, frustration there, and that's why he was so angry about it. Yeah. But
I'm just going to interrupt you there, 'cause I agree with you completely, your assessment, but just you, Alison and Gregor, in terms of those decisions and what Mikel Arteta was so upset about in VAR, what was your quick view on those kind of three moments?
Well, I mean, it is slightly odd and possibly embarrassing is the right word, that you invest so much money into assistant referee technology and you don't know if the ball's crossed the line or not because you haven't bothered putting enough technology in for that when it definitely exists. It's just stupid. Why not just do that? Can't draw the lines because there's of the way players are stood. Well, we all know there are goal mouth scrambles. Why don't you devise a system which allows you to see if someone is offside or not? It's unacceptable, I think, to say, oh, we just can't see in that instance. It's ridiculous. And also, we've got into a mess now in how it works in terms of taking the on-field decision and what they're seeing in Stockley Park. It's almost as if they're taking, just don't want to look at something that might be 60-40 because they don't want to go against what the on-field decision was. But isn't the whole point of looking at a goal and the incident, there's either a foul or there isn't, and that was a clear foul. So I can see why he's cross, because there's three separate, completely separate reasons why what might have ruled it out did not rule it out. And because you're quite right, Tom, the cumulative effect of that probably got, and the amount of minutes it took probably made him extra cross. But I do understand why he said the word embarrassing, because it just makes the system look a bit amateurish and shoddy.
Gregor, just on the decisions, we'll come back to Arteta and the wider implications.
No, I'm with Tom. I like when you look at it at the ball, one on the touchline. First of all, yeah, you can see that the ball's over the touchline. But we all know now, as that World Cup picture, that famous front page of the game, which you might have done with you on that day, where it was like an aerial shot of the game. Was it Japan against Germany?
Yeah.
The ball can look like it's out, but if it's overhanging, as Alison said, there's no technology to tell us right or wrong, so you've got to let that go. That's one. The offside doesn't look offside. I don't care about lines being drawn. Doesn't look offside to me. And even if it did, like I've spoken how this whole wormhole has got me into a place where like offsides feel like they should be subjective now to me. Anyway, and the foul, it didn't look like a foul when it was played at full speed. And anything you slow down when you look at someone, just because someone's got two hands on someone's back, doesn't mean it's a foul. Doesn't mean it's a push.
Hmm.
I don't think that was enough either. So,
and that's the defenders' union, because I thought it was interesting with the Luis Diaz goal for Luton, for Liverpool against Luton. There was a similar kind of freeze frame of when we were looking at the pictures yesterday, where he's kind of got his arms and body in the back of the Luton defender, and obviously that wasn't a foul.
Gabriel stooped to head it.
Yeah.
So if someone's stooping, you're the player behind them. It's a contact sport. You want to feel where they are. You put your hands there, and even if that kept them like slightly down, slightly delayed his motion to flick up, that's not a foul.
Not a foul. Fine. I think that's 2-1. I think in terms of the VAR.
Where are you?
I think I slightly sit with the lads on this one, Alison, I'm afraid. Overall, I think for these decisions, I can take your point about the technology not being good enough, and that in the world we live in seems a little strange. And I think your point about that making it fair for Arteta, who used the word embarrassing, is a good one. But I think overall, I think he's slightly out of line. And I think then when we fold in my next point, which is the club statement, which came out yesterday, which again on the desk, we're sometimes sitting around thinking, oh, it's a Sunday when it's Nottingham Forest against Aston Villa and Luton Liverpool, they're not the big Sunday games, where are we going to get our big story from? Obviously we were proved wrong in terms of the fixtures, but then that statement came out and Joe, my colleague, said, great, there's your back page story, thanks Arsenal, you look like right idiots now. But that to me didn't help, because the kind of doubling down was a bit, that to me is also embarrassing, Gregor.
It was pathetic. I think Arteta's was pathetic too. I honestly do. I agree about the kind of emotion. This has been something we've said of Arteta in the past. They can be too emotional. And the whole, you know, he was talking about, I think he said that we after the West Ham game, they lost in the cup, obviously 3-1. So this is two defeats in a week now. So part of me thinking, is he doing this to deflect away from the fact that they've lost two games in a week? But it was too much for that. So I think you can consign that idea. And then he was talking about how we spoke for 48 hours after that game that we didn't compete. So he has, there are enough kind of little signs to suggest that he's getting his team in a state that is not conducive to them winning the game or playing the way that they play best to win a game of football. And again, when you add up all those little things, he was given ample opportunity to explain further why he thought it was embarrassing as well. And he never took it. He just said there's many reasons. Well, explain them. And I hope he's asked that again in the next press conference. I hope he's asked.
Maybe we'll send you to ask
him.
Can
you please explain what you think is wrong here? And I know you could say you think the ball's out. We don't know that, Mikel. We don't know that. Okay, we think it might have been offside. It might have been. We don't know that. So it's a foul. That's one thing you could say, and that's just someone's opinion. It's subjective. But that's all VAR has done. We've said this numerous times. All it has done is open up new layers of subjectivity. And for that reason, we shouldn't have it.
Alison Rudd, I'm surprised, I must say, knowing you as I do, that you haven't chimed in with a "I told you so" at some point, given that this has been a theme of your assessment of Mikel Arteta as a manager for a long time. Has it not?
You know me too well, Mr. Clark.
You've not only been defending him and his views on VAR, but you have not jumped in on Tom's excellent analysis earlier and said, I told you this last year, which you did. Absolutely did.
Yeah. Well, I wonder what happened was they were without Ødegaard, who keeps a incredibly sensible, almost poetic charge of Arsenal. He's their heartbeat and makes sure they're all very grown up. You mentioned, Tom, they're a young team. He makes sure they're grown up. And without him there, I think Tom's right. I think they thought, oh, we have to compete in terms of other things now. If Ødegaard had been there, they could have won on superiority of football. But Newcastle have this thing, don't they? They have this thing where they just go at games like it's the very last game in the universe, and they're very pumped up, very physical, very quick, very passionate. And I think he felt without Ødegaard there, they were going to lose in terms of just not being at it enough. And he switched the dial too far so that they couldn't control it. And you wonder what he said to Havertz to make him make that challenge. Has he been asked to prove himself? Because he has a very diffident body language, Havertz. I'm sure he does care, but he looks like he doesn't. He sort of wanders around looking slightly aimless some of the time. And that gets that when you're not productive, then it's misinterpreted. And I think Arsenal fans are thinking, well, what are you bringing to the team? And why is our manager continuing to pick him? So he's been told, show that you care. So how do you show that you care if it's not your natural way of holding yourself? You just dive in on a ridiculous tackle to show that you care, and then that all that does is raise the hackles at St James's Park, and at that point you have lost the game.
The goalkeeper thing is interesting as well, because the whole idea with it bringing in David Raya was to supposedly increase the performance of two goalkeepers by having the competition and the rivalry. But I think we've basically seen this week, Ramsdale playing in midweek in that defeat to West Ham, Raya this weekend and recently, that you've basically got two good goalkeepers who are now playing worse because of the pressure, because of the hype, because of the tension. And I don't know about you, but I'm seeing suddenly Arsenal having to deal with a lot more kind of scrambles and in the penalty area, a lot more mess and chaos in around their six-yard box than they had last season. And I think that comes from a nervousness, you know, a lack of certainty, a lack of chemistry and connection between the defence and the goalkeeper. And I think what Arteta was trying to achieve, let's see, I mean, maybe, you know, David Raya establishes himself and becomes a great goalkeeper. But at the moment, that has become a problem that wasn't there. And just on the club statement, by the way, in Spain, this happens all the time now, because, well, I think in England it was never a thing, but we've had now with Liverpool, which I think was probably the first one, maybe. I mean, I can't remember one before that. But what it does is it opens a can of worms, you know, and then every club thinks, well, if Liverpool did it, we've got to send out one this week to make sure that we are saying that our decision was just as bad. And then next week there'll be someone else and saying, well, if we don't publish a statement, then everyone's going to think that we're okay with it. And in the end, what happens is every week there's a club basically saying, we're unhappy with the referee, we're going to threaten legal action, it's not good enough, and it becomes a huge thing. And all it does, by the way, which is what it's done in Spain and in Europe, where you have these ridiculous official statements coming out from club every week, is it fuels this sense of conspiracy. It fuels this idea that the referees don't have any authority and they're doing things wrong, not only by accident, but actually officially. Because when the clubs start talking about it officially, it becomes an actual kind of much more explicit thing. And it was obvious that was going to happen when Liverpool did it, and it's happened now, what, one or two weeks later. Arsenal are doing it, and it will happen now for the rest of the season.
I just wanted to raise one stat from Bill's column, which blew my mind.
Oh.
Over the last 20 league games, so the equivalent to just over half a season, Manchester United have won more points than Arsenal. Does that blow anyone else's mind?
Say that again.
Over the last 20 league games, so the equivalent of half a season, Manchester United have won more points than Arsenal, 37 to 36.
Blind. No, just that doesn't blow my mind, because Arsenal threw away the title, didn't they?
But still, as a surface level fact, that is quite strong.
I know it kind of doesn't mean anything because it crosses two seasons, but yeah, that's amazing. One other thing, look, we can't ignore Newcastle here, come on.
Listen, I didn't want to say it, that's always my line.
Listen, tip of the hat to Michael Walker here, the journalist, a tweet he tweeted after this game. Of the 15 players used by Newcastle United in this game, 8 were signed by Steve Bruce, Rafa Benitez or Alan Pardew, and Sean Longstaff came through the academy. This is now their team from last season. Like, all the players they signed are injured or suspended or whatever. This was his 2-year anniversary, Eddie Howe. Like, whatever we say about it, and I know, listen, we always raise this and we should, but the job Eddie Howe has done is is unrivalled in those 2 years in the Premier League.
If you're going to sports wash, you may as well sports wash well.
Okay, but the sports washing bit is like the washing of the players in the squad. It's not really had much effect on Eddie Howe's team, that's all I'm saying now. This is an incredible job. The fourth home game in a row without conceding a goal, 4 wins. That place, we're speaking about a lot of stadiums that are, you know, kind of really important for teams. That place is probably the hardest place to go now in the Premier League.
Eddie Howe definitely deserving of some praise, Gregor. And you can read more amazing stats and facts from Bill Edgar in his column on the Times website now. But we want to finish with another manager who deserves praise and has got a lot of it, Emma Hayes. Molly Hudson writing this morning that the USA job is the only way to step up from Chelsea. The inspirational manager's decision to leave West London next summer is being compared to the end of Sir Alex Ferguson's reign at Manchester United. I've got to say, this was one when that's the story kind of came out that Emma Hayes had decided to leave. She hasn't actually confirmed whether or not she's going to take the job of the United States women's team or not, but we believe that that might be the only vacancy big enough for her. This did feel like a huge moment for the women's game. She has been such a kind of beacon of not only success on the pitch, but in terms of her punditry during the international tournaments when people are going, wow, this is amazing. Her punditry is way better than everyone else's. She actually knows her stuff and prepares and things. To lose her from the English game and to lose her from the women's game in this country is a big moment, isn't it, Alison?
It's a slap in the face for English, the FA, actually, because she was the obvious choice to be England women manager. I mean, you know, she was obvious. Obvious. Knew what she was doing. Very successful. On a wonderful trajectory. I remember seeing her early in her career at Chelsea and how she's progressed since then. She has a desire to learn and learn and learn. But she said, no way do I want that job. No way do I want to have that sort of exposure that the media give you and the way the whole thing is handled, at not being with the players often enough to be the international manager. I don't want that. Don't want that. And yet she's prepared to do it overseas, it seems, which implies that they've given her reassurances that the English FA cannot. So I do feel it's a bit of a slap in the face for the way that the FA run things slightly. And yeah, she, I mean, she is the only manager anyone who isn't all over football will be able to say is a manager of a women's team in this country. She's famous, and she's done it by hard graft and really working at it and being a superb man manager. She's just very good at getting the right people into Chelsea, whether they're coaching staff or the players. She wants there to be a, you know, the right mood, the right commitment, and so on. And I think everyone will hope she can win the Champions League with Chelsea. It's the one trophy she's not won, and it'd be a great send-off for her to go out with that. Don't know if she will be able to do it or not, but that would be very fitting for someone who's just devoted herself to enhancing the women's game. But it does make me just feel slightly odd that she was so adamant she was not interested in the national job, but she will go to America.
Yes, well, we'll see what the future holds for Emma Hayes. And I would recommend you reading Molly Hudson's piece, because it not only sums up this moment for her and the women's game, but it also outlines what a brilliant success she has been at Chelsea. Tom Allnutt, Alison Rudd and Gregor Robertson, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you too for listening. We will be back on Thursday to discuss the latest Champions League action.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.